compelling insights, unpredictable conversations, encouragement for your day. It's the Patrick Madrid Show on Relevant Radio.
Good morning and welcome back to the Patrick Madrid Show. Thank you. As ever, thank you for listening. Obviously, if you've watched the news this morning, you saw the terrible news about a bridge collapse in Baltimore. This is the bridge that goes over the Patapsco River, Francis Scott Key Bridge. And if you haven't seen this, there is video that shows a huge container ship that is leaving the port of Baltimore and making its way. It was supposed to go under that bridge and get out into the open waters. But instead, for some reason, they're still obviously investigating. It took place about 1 in the morning last night. The ship hit one of the huge pylons that holds the bridge up and utterly collapsed the bridge. There were cars and trucks on the bridge. There were, the accounts say that there were construction workers who were doing repairs on the bridge. And all of those people were precipitated into the water. There was some reporting this morning about maybe an explosion of some sort on the ship before it hit this piling. The authorities have said they don't think there's any connection with terrorism or anything like that. Because, I mean, you can see this ship hitting the bridge. It's just a terrible tragedy. So I wanted to begin this program today, first of all, acknowledging the pain and grief that's unbelievable, hard to imagine, and all of our listeners in the Relevant Radio family in Baltimore listening on our 750 AM station, WBMD, please know of our deep solidarity with you. I hope that they find survivors, and we continue to hope for the best. But this just happened a matter of hours ago, so it's still unfolding. But if you haven't seen this yet, I would suggest looking at the video. It is upsetting to see this bridge collapse, but it's amazing how quickly, I mean, it's just like standing, and then next thing you know, after this ship hits the pylon, it just completely collapses. Cyrus, you saw the video too, right? You saw it this morning?
Yeah, it was the first thing I saw this morning. And you see this giant ship. It looks like it loses power, mm-hmm. and it starts drifting. The power comes back on. Only
the lights come on too.
The lights come on the ship. That's right. And then it looks like the power goes out again. And moments after that, it collides with the center of this bridge. Mm-hmm. And I've never seen something come down so fast.
It is remarkable. And I assume it's in real time. I don't think it was delayed or slowed down or anything like that. It's just an instantaneous utter collapse of the whole thing. Now, this, by the way, is going to completely close the port of Baltimore. That was the way in and out from what I could see looking at a map this morning. So all the shipping and everything else that's associated with that waterway, not to mention the traffic that would pass over that bridge, the Francis Scott Key Bridge, that's all shut down today. I mean, it's going to be closed for who knows how long. And right now, the urgent duty is for rescue workers to try to find anybody who survived this this bridge collapse. So this happened early this morning, and I bring it to your attention not because I, you know, who wants to hear news like this, but like you said, Cyrus, it's the very first thing that I saw when I turned on the news this morning. I do have a thought correlated with this terrible tragedy, and it's worth thinking about. This is from St. James, chapter 4, verse 13. He says, "Come now, you who say, today or tomorrow we will go into such and such a town and spend a year there and trade and get gain, whereas you do not know about tomorrow. What is your life? You are like a mist that appears for a little time and then vanishes. Instead, you ought to say, if the Lord wills, we shall live and we shall do this or that." This passage comes to my mind whenever I see a tragedy like this. And the reason for it, I think, is salutary to remember that life is full of unknowns. And the old saying, always be prepared, the Boy Scout motto, be prepared. always be prepared. Be in the state of grace. If you are in the state of serious sin, run, don't walk, and get to confession, because you don't know. Cyrus, the most eerie thing about this was watching one after another of these trucks and other vehicles going across this bridge, knowing that at any moment it was going to collapse. The first time I saw the video, I'm thinking, is this truck going to go in the water? And they would pass and pass. And then the last truck that passes over that span, and only a few seconds after that, the bridge collapses. You know, I think what a difference a matter of a few seconds makes in someone's life, and all the people who didn't get over that bridge. I don't know if you have anything you want to add to that, Cyrus, but this is a story top of mind today. And we do send our sincere condolences, our heartfelt condolences to all of our listeners in the Baltimore area and everybody affected by this. We'll find out more details as time goes on. 888-914-9149. Let's see. Let's go to Renee now in Rock City, Illinois. Good morning, Renee.
Good morning, Patrick. Hello, Cyrus. I'm a volunteer youth minister in our small town parish, and we just watched The Passion of Christ on Sunday. Mm-hmm. And of course, my kids stumped me with something. So,
of course, they're good at that, aren't they?
Yes, exactly. When Jesus was crucified and he went to Sheol to gather up Moses and Abraham and all the prophets before us, so the question came up, did purgatory not exist then? Or like, how was the kingdom of heaven established? And do you have any books to recommend that I can catch up on that?
Yeah, sure. So Sheol being the Hebrew word and Hades, the Greek version, it is the place maybe more broadly known. We wouldn't use the word purgatory per se, but it is the place known as the underworld. It's where the dead would go, the good and the bad. And the church teaches that because of Adam and Eve's sin. Now, these are probably some things you already know, but just to rehearse, because of Adam and Eve's sin, the gates of heaven were closed until the Redeemer came and reopened them, Jesus, by his death on the cross. So everybody who died in the human family went into Sheol or Hades. And we're told by Jesus himself in Luke 16 that there was a place reserved for the good, the righteous of the Old Testament era. And there was another place that was reserved for those who were wicked and would be punished. And you know the story of Lazarus and the rich man. So Jesus really gives us a very vivid description of this place or this situation, circumstance. And one noteworthy thing is that when the rich man asks Abraham to send Lazarus to cool his tongue with some water because of the flames, etc., Abraham says no. And he also says there's a great gulf or chasm fixed between where you are and where we are. We cannot cross over to you, and you cannot cross over to us, suggesting that it's all the same place, but the place of punishment was reserved, and here's where we get to the particular question you have, was reserved for those who were damned and possibly also for those who were saved, but they needed some special purification, as St. Paul talks about in 1 Corinthians 3, beginning in verse 10, that those bad works of their lives may need to be purified. And he uses the analogy in 1 Corinthians 3. It's not really an analogy per se, because this fire is real, but in an otherworldly sense. It's not physical fire, but the bad works of one's life are burned off, he says. The man who's there is suffering loss as these bad works are burned off. He says he will be saved, but only as though passing through fire. So one way to look at that is that we could theorize that perhaps there was a purgatorial nature of that place of torment for those who eventually would be saved. And I've always been intrigued by that passage, Renee. This is Luke 16, because in it, something very enigmatic happens, and that is where the rich man, I think most people just commonly assume that he was damned, and he may well have been, for all I know. But I'm intrigued by the fact that he asks, he's interceding on behalf of his brothers who are still alive. He's looking out for them in some sense, hoping that they would not come there, and hoping that somebody would go warn them to amend their lives so they wouldn't go there. So that, to me, suggests he had some kind of charity. Now, I've heard all the arguments against that theory, and we don't have to hash them out. But for me, that's at least a glimmer of possibility that that could have been purgatorial for those who were destined to go to heaven. We don't know with certitude. But what we can say is that, as the Bible clearly teaches, for those who are not prepared to see God face to face, because nothing unclean can enter heaven, Revelation 21:27. Therefore, for those who die in the state of grace, they die in the state of friendship with God, and yet they have these effects of their sins remaining that need to be purified, then in some manner, that's what purgatory is. And it's hard to know what is that, to what extent does that telescope into the underworld from the time before Jesus? Is it an extension of the same thing? I think it is. That's my guess on this. We know purgatory is real. We know people really do go there. And I think it would be safe to say that what we see Jesus describing in Luke 16 could be understood in that manner. Does that make sense? Does it clarify it for you?
Yeah. Do you have any good books that you recommend, like, on the topic?
Yeah. There's one called Hungry Souls, and I don't remember now the name of the author. I think it's a German author or a French author. It's in English, so for American readers, you can read it in English. Just look for that book called Hungry Souls. Okay. And then another book is called Purgatory. Who's that little lamb that I hear in the background there?
That's my dude.
Ah, little guy. So this book is called Purgatory, and it's by the same author who wrote that. He wrote that book that I talk about on the show from time to time called The Dogma of Hell. So Father F.X. Schuppe, this is the name of the author, S-C-H-O-U-P-P-E, and he wrote this book on purgatory. So it's largely drawing upon the comments of the church fathers on this topic to the extent that you see it in scripture. Unfortunately, it's written in a 19th century writing style, so it's not the way we currently write or speak, but it's still well worth it. And the stories that are told about from the lives of the saints and others to whom God permitted souls in purgatory from time to time to manifest themselves, to ask for prayer, to explain what it's like. St. Catherine of Siena, she has a very powerful description of her own visions of purgatory. So if you want to look that up, those are available online if you wanted to read it. St. Catherine of Siena would be the authoress. So those are some recommendations I'd give you, Renee.
Okay, thank you.
You're welcome. Nice chatting with you. 888-914-9149. How about Brandon now in Rio Rancho, New Mexico? Good morning, Brandon.
Good morning, Patrick. I recently had a conversation with a friend of mine, and he made a comment, obviously a slight towards Catholics. He said, "You Catholics follow the guy in the pointy hat who has a direct line to God." And I didn't have a chance to really question what he means by that, but I've heard it more than once, so I'm not quite sure where that comes from or what's meant by that comment.
He's probably referring to the mitre, which is the ceremonial hat or headdress that bishops wear. And it has changed somewhat over the years, but it's not so much, I guess you could say it's pointy, I suppose, but you've seen a bishop or certainly the Pope wearing a mitre, right?
Correct, yeah.
That's what he's referring to.
And what does he mean by he has a direct line to God?
Well, what he means is that he doesn't understand the Catholic Church. He doesn't realize it, that he doesn't understand the Catholic Church, because the Catholic Church does not teach that the Pope has a direct line to God, or that the Pope has special revelatory powers, or that the Pope is inspired by the Holy Spirit, or any of those things. None of those things are anything the church has ever taught. The only Pope who's ever been inspired by the Holy Spirit was St. Peter. And after that, all the popes had to learn things the old-fashioned way. You know, they had to learn. They had to read books. They had to consult experts. So he's misunderstanding the church's teaching on infallibility, but what he has in his mind is not what the church teaches. To say that the Pope has a direct line to God. He has no more of a direct line to God than you do.
Okay. All right, yeah, I just, as he explained it, or he made that comment, it was definitely a slight towards the Catholic faith. So I wasn't quite sure where that information, or if it was a common, quote-unquote, critique of the Catholic faith.
Well, that's not even a critique. That's just a silly assertion. And if you want, I mean, if you really want to know how to blow the doors off those kind of things, I wrote a book called Pope Fiction, Answers to 30 Myths and Misconceptions About the Papacy. And it just is, I look at all the major and many of the minor arguments that are raised against the papacy. And more often than not, they arise from a misunderstanding like this fellow has. But if you were to read that book, I'm not trying to sell you a book, but I mean, if you want a resource that has everything compiled in one volume, you might want to take a look at Pope Fiction. Oh, there we go. I don't think I heard what you just said. So can you repeat it?
Oh, no, I was just thanking you for your time.
Oh, you're most welcome. Well, thank you. Appreciate that. Appreciate the call. It's certainly an interesting topic, everybody. If you've heard people say similar things and you'd like to know, well, how do I explain? What does the church even really teach about papal infallibility? What does that mean? Does that mean the Pope is always right about everything he says? No. Does that mean the Pope is inspired by the Holy Spirit? No. Does that mean, what about the bad popes? What about the popes who commit terrible sins? There have been some of them. Adulterers and murderers and simoniacs and others. What about them? Doesn't that disprove? No. It doesn't disprove anything. It just proves that, as Jesus said in Matthew 16:18, upon this rock I will build my church, and the gates of hell will not prevail against it. So the papacy is a fascinating institution established by Jesus Christ and sustained by him, but populated with human sinners. So if you're ever interested in looking at what the church really teaches as opposed to what somebody thinks the church teaches, that might be a book to take a look at. Thank you. We're going to take a break, and we'll come right back. 888-914-9149. You may know that in the schools, there is a lot of ideology being pumped out to the kids on transgender topics, etc. Well, I've got some information from a scientific and scholarly background that might help you if you're interested in knowing how to respond to those things. I'll tell you about that right after this. This hour is sponsored by Christendom College's free Principles classes. Sign up for a free online class on Holy Scripture today at NewTestamentFoundations.com. Learn to read the Bible with the mind of the church at NewTestamentFoundations.com.
Compellingly inclusive and fully woke. Diverse and unpredictable conversations. Equality for your day. Your non-triggering, non-toxic ally. This is the Patrick Madrid Show on Relevant Radio.
Well, she's right about the non-toxic part. That is true. She should have thrown in free range and cage free.
I think it depends on who you ask.
And organic. Those are true. I don't know about the full... I'm awake. I wouldn't say I'm fully woke, though. I'm on to that stuff. So here's what I have for you. 888-914-9149. So, you know, the Olympics are coming up. And this is a meta study that was done by science. It's an academic paper that was delivered. I'll just read you the article here. A group of 26 academics have challenged the International Olympic Committee's framework on the inclusion of transgender athletes in sports, saying it does not protect fairness for women, nor does it align with scientific or medical evidence. The paper published this week in the Scandinavian Journal of Medicine and Science in Sports, both peer-reviewed journals, said decisions on eligibility for female competition must consider male development rather than testosterone levels. And here are a couple quotes from the paper. We urge the IOC, the International Olympic Committee, to reevaluate the recommendations of their framework to include a comprehensive understanding of the biological advantages of male development to ensure fairness and safety in female sports. Sports face the uncomfortable reality that the inclusion of transgender women, and they don't put that in quotation marks, but I'm going to put air quotes around that, the inclusion of transgender women in female sports categories cannot be reconciled with fairness and, in some instances, safety for females in athletic sports. Cyrus, you've seen the videos of girl athletes, wrestlers, and others who just get bruised and battered, the kind of thing that would land a guy in jail if he did that outside of a sporting event. You've seen that before, haven't you?
Yeah, it's unconscionable. I've seen a UFC fight with a transgender man literally pummeling a woman.
Yeah, to the point where you think, is she even going to live through this?
And this is somehow not only allowed, but celebrated?
I know. It's the insanity of the whole thing. The IOC framework on fairness, inclusion, and non-discrimination on the basis of gender identity and sex variations, try to say that five times fast, is a document produced to guide international sports federations when establishing their own rules. Look, here's what they're saying is, here's how ridiculously unscientific we do what we do. So we're hoping you guys will follow us. We point you toward the position statement, IOC framework on fairness, inclusion, and non-discrimination on the basis of gender identity and sex variations, published within the British Journal of Sports Medicine. And this is a spokesperson, a spokesman, let's just say, from the IOC. Within the statement, there is an explanation of the principle of no presumption of advantage, as well as more details about an evidence-based approach. That's what they say. Global governing bodies for cricket, cycling, athletics, swimming, and chess have tightened their eligibility for elite women's competitions over the last couple of years. Chess, I'm not so sure about. I saw a movie, I don't remember what it was, not that long ago, a young woman kind of up and coming through the 60s.
Queen's Gambit?
Queen's Gambit. She blew away all the guys. She was the best chess player in the house every time. I don't know if they need to worry so much about that for chess, but maybe there's something about it that I don't know.
We're not talking about smarts here.
No, clearly not.
Women are clearly smarter than men.
Well, but even there, I mean, just to be fair, there's some really intelligent men. There's some really intelligent women.
My wife is listening. I have to say that.
Yeah, that's true. So you can check that box for the day. That's a good point. Other sports at international and national levels allow transgender athletes to compete in women's sports if they can show reduced levels of testosterone. The paper said the framework's instruction that federations make no presumption of advantage due to the athlete's transgender status. And here's the crux of it. It ignores the permanent advantage held by anyone who has been through male puberty, that is a male, a man, a man. They said, I mean, this is so, it's so amazing to me that this even has to be pointed out. Like these scholars saying, hey guys, you know, time out. If you really want to be evidence-based, let's look at the evidence, like the scientific evidence, the physiological evidence. And there's just no question but that men are bigger, stronger, more often than not faster. Not every man, obviously. Not every man, obviously. Studies show that transgender women with suppressed testosterone retain muscle mass, strength, and other physical advantages compared to females. Here again, this whole clown world that we live in. Transgender women compared to females. Thank you. Yeah, I didn't even have to ask you for it. You knew. Yep. I still have some of the duct tape on from last time we discussed this. Let's see, studies. Well, I don't want to give this a complete read, but you should read it, parents, especially. I mean, and it's got a link to the study.
Come on, man.
Seriously. I haven't heard Maddie for a while. How's Maddie doing?
Come on, man.
I know, but it's science, you know? So, I mean, you can't trump science, can you? I would encourage parents to take a look at this, and it could come in handy when you're talking to the people at your kid's school. Unless, of course, you homeschool, in which case you'd be talking to yourself. But I'm sure that if you're homeschooling, you're not teaching this ideology.
I'm seeing a lot less of these problems with the homeschooled kids. Just,
you know what? You're
right.
It's
just an observation. I could be wrong, but
I don't think there's any problem with the homeschool kids.
I don't either.
In this area. But the people who, this is what I find so vexing, is that the people who push this, I understand there's a money motive, because if you're a physician, for example, and you work at a medical center, a hospital, what have you, that specializes in these modification surgeries, there's a lot of money to be made. there's a lot of money to be made in academia. Let's say if you are on the tenure track, or maybe you've already got tenure, and you're interested in funding for your research projects and getting published, and getting published by the right publishing companies to enhance your career, there's a lot of money to be made if you toe the line. And people, well, we saw a kind of microcosm of that during COVID, where people who in the medical field, you know, doctors, scientists, and others who disagreed publicly with the established wisdom on things like the efficacy of masks and vaccinations and that whole rigmarole. You probably remember it happened a few years ago. I know we've all been trying to put it out of our minds, but you may remember that era of COVID when, granted, the vast majority of people who were speaking up on the topic of things like vaccines, etc., they were saying one thing almost monolithically, but there were other people who were bona fide. They had the credentials and the letters after their names, and they had many years of experience. And they were saying, well, wait a minute, this, what about this part of the science over here? And they were routinely shouted down and silenced and deplatformed. Boy, do you remember those days? So I just offer that to you as a reminder about how things like this, even though you may have 20 some odd scholars who are experts in their field who are standing up and saying, this is not a good idea, and this is not really about fairness, they're likely to get shouted down, unfortunately, but that's the way things tend to go these days. 888-914-9149. Let's go to Letta now in Sylmar, California. Good morning, Letta.
Good morning. Oh, that was quick. Thanks for all you do, Patrick. So my question is, in your confession helper, there was this, it says there that if a patient, if a woman commits an abortion, she is automatically excommunicated. But I read in an article that Pope Francis gave the authority to priests to pardon or absolve the sin. Mm-hmm. Can you clarify?
Sure.
Or am I?
So, no, you're on the right track. Let's put it that way. So in the case of a procured abortion, an intentionally procured abortion, there are two phenomena. One is the sin itself, and the other is the canonical penalty for that sin, which is in the church's law, that particular sin. And there are others. There are other kinds of sins one could commit that are known as delicts or crimes. And so in the case of that particular crime of abortion, it not only incurs the guilt of the sin, but also the excommunication. There's an automatic excommunication that takes place. It doesn't require the church to formally declare it. So you're correct in that the priests already have the power given by Jesus to the church. In John 20, he gives the power to the apostles to forgive sins. And so the priest can absolve the woman or the abortion doctor or the abortion nurse or the mother or grandmother or father who pressured a daughter into having an abortion, or the boyfriend who drove her to get the abortion, that kind of thing. People who are directly involved. The priest has the authority and the power to sacramentally absolve them from sin, but without the permission from the bishop, the local bishop, the excommunication cannot be lifted. But you'd be happy to know that bishops routinely sort of blanket authorize all the priests who are in good standing in their diocese to automatically lift the excommunication when the woman or whoever is involved goes to confession. So they're two related but separate issues. Do you see what I mean?
Somewhat.
Okay, let me put it this way. Let's say you committed a crime of embezzling money from your company. Okay, that's a crime under the law. It's also a sin. So you could go to confession, Letta, and be truly sorry for embezzling money, and the priest can forgive you. He can give you sacramental absolution, and before God, you were forgiven from this sin. But it doesn't mean that you're now going to skate away from justice. You could be arrested and put in prison. So that part of it would be where the excommunication deals with this, where that penalty is removed. It would be as if the judge said, okay, Letta, you went to confession. We know you're sorry. So we're going to now lift that penalty. There's a criminal penalty here. We're going to cancel that. You're not going to go to prison. It would be kind of like that.
Oh.
You see the distinction?
Oh, okay. Yeah. Oh, okay. All right. Because I was so confused about your confession helper, because it says there. And so now it's clear. Thank you so much, Patrick. Thank you so much.
You're welcome. Okay. You sound happy now, and I'm glad I can bring some sunshine to your world.
No, it's just this confusion about the excommunication. So, All right.
Okay, well, I'm glad we were able to cover that. And we always are happy to get feedback about the Relevant Radio app. It's constantly being updated and worked on and improved and tweaked for good things. So anytime, you know, you come across something and you say, well, here's a thought, could we say it differently or say it better or something like that? We're always open to that kind of constructive advice. So thank you for that, Letta. And once again, for everybody, abortion is a sin. It's also a canonical crime. That's where the penalty of excommunication arises. Now, not every mortal sin is a crime, according to the church's law. Let me give you another example of what would be a crime. If a priest were to divulge the contents of your confession, so you go to confession, Father McGillicuddy hears your confession, and then let's say over dinner and drinks, you know, with friends a week or two or three later, or a year later, whatever, and he just starts telling other people, number one, that you went to confession and, God forbid, what you said in confession. That's a serious sin. It's also a canonical crime. So that would be an example of a canonical crime, a delict, which incurs auto excommunication. There's a phrase for it in Latin, but don't bother with that. The fact is it incurs the excommunication ipso facto. By the very fact of doing the act itself, you excommunicate yourself. So the church takes these things very seriously, but I don't want anyone to have the wrong impression to think that every single mortal sin you could commit also has an excommunication attached to it. No. It's certain ones, abortion being one of them. I hope that's helpful. There is a helpful weblog that I have used many times before. It's called Canon Law Made Easy, by a canon lawyer named Kathy Caridi. You can look it up, Canon Law Made Easy. And she's got, many, many, many articles on lots of canonical questions like this one, especially ones that pertain to lay people. So if you're ever wondering, what would a canon lawyer say about such and such a scenario, go to that weblog and you chances are going to find an article about that. All right, we're going to take a quick time out and we'll be back with more on a Taco Tuesday. And please remember, as we conclude our Lenten season and draw near to the Easter Triduum, you can use this Holy Week to prepare your heart and mind with Close to Jesus to the Last. Every day at 11 a.m. and 6 p.m. Central, we'll take a pause with Father Rocky to delve into the events of Jesus' last days before his passion. All the details available at relevantradio.com/holy-week. relevantradio.com/holy-week. Thanks to network sponsor PushPay. PushPay offers parishes a platform for tracking donations and sacraments, overseeing schedules, mobile apps to help manage your administrative load, and much more. Info at relevantradio.com/pushpay. That's relevantradio.com/pushpay.
This is the Patrick Madrid Show on Relevant Radio and relevantradio.com.
Can you tell it's Taco Tuesday? 888-914-9149. You can call that number now. Let's get over to Dan in Dayton, Ohio. Good morning, Dan.
Hello, Patrick.
Yes, sir.
So my wife and I just finished watching last night the movie Jesus of Nazareth.
Yes.
And the excellent movie, by the way. I'm 64 years old, and I don't know why I haven't watched it yet, but that was my first time. Then the gospel at the Sunday's Mass, mm-hmm. with the Passion had me wondering why Judas had to identify Jesus to the authorities. I mean, Jesus was, you know, he marched triumphantly into Jerusalem mm-hmm. on Palm Sunday. He was well known. He taught in the temple for days leading up to his Passion.
Right. In fact, and Jesus He says, why are you coming to me in the dead of night to arrest me this way? You could have arrested me any day of the week because I was out in public and you could have done this then. You're right about that.
So I'm wondering, mm-hmm. yeah, why did Judas have to do what he did? And I've come to the conclusion that, and I want to get your opinion on this, obviously, I've come to the conclusion that Judas is representative of everyone who betrays Jesus through their sin.
But, that's an interesting take. Interesting take. And there's some theological merit to that, too. I don't know that that's a theme that I've seen so much in the commentaries on the Gospels, but that is an interesting way of looking at it. I believe there are multiple reasons, and the first one would be that this was Judas freely chose to betray Jesus. We're told at the Last Supper, he became possessed by the devil. We're told the devil entered into him. Mm-hmm. Interestingly, at the end of John chapter 6 in the Bread of Life discourse, that presumably was at least a year or so before the time of the Lord's Passion. Even there, Jesus identifies Judas Iscariot as a devil. He says, did I not choose each of you, the 12, and yet one of you is a devil? And we're told that he was referring to Judas. So that seems to comport with what we're told at the Last Supper, that Jesus became possessed by the devil. So why did he do it that way? Why did he go in darkness and kiss Jesus as a sign to the soldiers that he's the one that they should arrest? Part of it could be because it was dark. So you know how it is in the dark.
Yeah.
You can't see things quite as easily. And there were presumably more than just Jesus and his apostles there. So you've got the crowd of the temple guard, you've got Pharisees and other people, you probably have the people who maybe, as we talked about yesterday, the man who owned the garden, maybe his family were there. There could have been enough people there, and also it being dark, that this was a way that Judas said, well, I will tell you exactly who this person is. The kiss, and not this is obviously not a kiss on the mouth, this is a kiss on the cheek, as they do in even to this day, the Middle East, it's common for men to kiss each other on either cheek. So that, too, would be part of the betrayal in that this intimate, friendly, I'm close to you and I know you well enough that I can kiss you on the cheek as a sign of friendship, that he used this as the way to betray Jesus, making it all the more horrible, as opposed to, say, pointing him out. And I'm sure that the church fathers and St. Thomas and others who commented on it with far, you know, greater powers of erudition than I have would see other reasons for this as well. But those are the ones that come to my mind when I read the passage or when I heard it read at the Gospel on Sunday.
Right. Well, that makes sense.
Yeah. And, you know, it's always easy to consult the Bible commentaries. The Catholic Commentary on Holy Scripture by Dom Bernard Orchard is one that I go to a lot just to see what he has to say. Also, the Haydock Bible Commentary, that's the one on the IPA app. I was talking about that yesterday, and those are all free. Mm-hmm. So even if you just put it on your phone, you could quickly look up what the commentators say or the church fathers, things like that.
Right. Okay, can I make one last comment?
Sure.
As you came back from the previous, not the most recent commercial break, but the previous commercial break, you talked about being unwoke and all these other things. Mm-hmm. You need to add non-GMO in there as well.
Non-GMO. I think that's an accurate description. I have not been genetically modified,
that's
to
correct.
My knowledge, at least. Have you ever been genetically modified, Dan?
Absolutely not.
Yeah. Okay. Well, we're in good company then.
Yeah. All right. Well,
thanks for the call.
Good fight. We love your program. We love Relevant Radio, and we pray for you guys every day.
Thanks, Dan. We appreciate that very much. And it's great to have all of our Dayton listeners and Cincinnati listeners with us, all the people all around the great state of Ohio who listen to Relevant Radio now, who didn't have a station not all that long ago. And we're looking forward to adding more stations, especially in Central Ohio, so we can get the word out. 888-914-9149. How about Cotija or Cotija? I don't know how you pronounce it in Pennsylvania. Good morning.
Good morning, Hello? Patrick. Just wondering. Yes, can you hear me?
Yes, Hello? I can. Mm-hmm.
Okay,
Hello?
Stop.
Cotija, can you hear me?
Wondering.
Hello?
Yes.
Okay.
Yes, can you hear me? Hello?
Hello?
Hello.
Can you hear me?
Hello? Yeah. Can you hear me?
Yeah, I can. Let's go for it.
Hi there.
Okay, my question, why are exorcist priests considered in a higher regard than priests who don't perform exorcisms? And why do dioceses keep their identities, not publicized?
Two good questions. The first one, I don't know that people do hold exorcists in any higher regard. I mean, I haven't heard that from anybody. They're priests like all the other priests, but they have a particular ministry that they're given by their bishop. So maybe you've met somebody who said that. I don't think I have. So I'm not sure what to say on the first question other than that. As to why do the bishops not let their names be known publicly? Well, for the privacy of the exorcist, because if it were known generally publicly that Father McGillicuddy was an exorcist, can you imagine all of the importuning that would go on? People, at the drop of a hat, asking him to come and give an exorcism or something like that, perform an exorcism. And of course, this ministry has a very specific way of being carried out. And it would just probably, I'm guessing, it would probably make his life so fraught with people writing to him, calling him, showing up at his house, that kind of thing. So for his own privacy, so that he can conduct his ministry in an efficient way. And there are probably some other reasons for it. In addition to that, I have to give that some thought. I wonder if some of these exorcists who are authors, like Father Gabriel Amorth, for example, I wonder if maybe they talk about that from their perspective. Have you ever read any of their books? Is it Cotija or Cotija? How do you pronounce your name?
Cotija.
Cotija.
About an exorcist priest being any quote-unquote holier than a regular priest, but I was taken aback by a conversation that I kind of stumbled upon with some women within the diocese who were kind of like, oh, who is our exorcist priest? I want to go to him to confession. He's mm-hmm. going to give me better guidance. And so that kind of struck me. So I was wondering, was there something I was missing? And they were kind of disheartened that they couldn't find out who the exorcist priest was within our diocese.
You know, it's funny you mention that, because that would be an example of why they're not allowed to know who the exorcist priest is, for that very reason, because you'd have people clamoring like these ladies, and that could lead to some really serious misunderstandings, like, well, my confession will be better or more powerful or something if I go to confess to this exorcist priest than it would be if I go to my regular parish priest. That's a misunderstanding, because all priests have the same power when it comes to the sacrament. And especially since, generally speaking, the sacrament of confession is not intended for spiritual direction, especially when you have 10 people waiting in line behind you. They get pretty antsy. So it's not even, normally it's not a conducive situation for the kind of information she might be looking for. And another reason just popped into my mind, Cotija, and that is that there are many people who are interested in signs and wonders, and they have a craving to know about things like that, that can for some become unhealthy. And so if the priest of the diocese who's designated as the official exorcist, if that were publicly known, I think there are a lot of people who follow after signs and wonders, and they have a craving for this kind of thing. That's the kind of person who could begin to make life miserable for a priest like that. That's another. So what you just said kind of reinforces in my mind that reality.
Thank you so much. Yes, it makes sense. I appreciate you and your time.
Thank you. Appreciate that. And for those interested, the exorcist who I have read a couple of books from, his name was, he's since gone on to his eternal reward, Father Gabriel Amorth, A-M-O-R-T-H. And he, the first book that he wrote is called An Exorcist Tells His Story. And it's amazing and hair-raising, but very edifying as well, because you realize that there's so much more that goes into this ministry than what many people might assume. And they might be thinking, you know, the Exorcist movie or other movies like that. And it's much, I would say it's much more than that. And it's also, in many respects, very different from that. It's not as garish or as spectacular in a bad way. It can get that way, from what I understand, but generally speaking, it's a lot more mundane than I think people realize. So it'd be helpful, if you're interested in such things, to read a book from a qualified and experienced exorcist like Father Gabriel Amorth. Let's go now to Mark in Wilmington, Delaware. Good morning, Mark.
Good morning, Patrick.
How are you? Yes, sir. I'm well, thank you.
Good. The Passion of our Lord Jesus Christ, according to Mark, is it every year according to Mark, or does it change yearly?
Well, because it changes over the course of 3 years. The church has a cycle of readings that cycles through the four Gospels year by year. Now, it's not like only this Gospel for this year, but the readings that are drawn from the four Gospels will be different for that three-year cycle. So we are, I forget which cycle we're in right now, A, B, or C. You can look it up, actually. If you go to the U.S. Conference of Catholic Bishops website, it's usccb.org, and you could use the search bar if you wanted to, but you would be able to look at the cycle of readings. And then if you wanted to, for example, you could go to next year and see what the Passion reading will be taken from in 2025, for example.
Oh, that's cool. That's great. I have one more question.
Sure.
Jesus says, the one of the 12, the one who dips with me into the dish, the one B goes and written. So, like, did he tell all of them that, you know, the one who dips with me into the dish, why would, and they all were distressed about it, why would Judas dip into the dish with Jesus if he knew he was going to be the one?
Mm-hmm. Well, as I read that passage, it was distressing, first of all, because Jesus was saying, one of you, my inner circle, my closest friends, my collaborators, my apostles, one of you is going to betray me. So can you imagine how consternated they must have felt, except for Judas, I guess. So I think that's one, if that's part of what you're asking me, that seems to be one reason why. The other reason is to show a sign so that they would know. Now, there is a sacramental / theological meaning, a deeper meaning here about dipping your hand at the same time as the Lord, that sharing of food, that intimate connection. But I've run out of time, Mark. So forgive me for that, okay. But thank you for the questions. I hope you'll call me back another time. Until 2 minutes from now, I'll pray for you. Please pray for me. And I'll be right back with more of the show right after this. Now!